The modern Israeli wine industry was founded by Baron Edmund James of the Rothschild, owner of Bordeaux estate Chateau Lafite Rothschild. But evidence shows that wine was made by locals for centuries before his arrival. At the beginning of the modern era, the planting were mostly near the Mediterranean Sea, an area that proved to be too warm for quality wine production. The wine industry has gradually moved northwards to the Galilee and eastwards towards Jerusalem in search of higher elevation. With my guest today, Adam Montefiore, the English voice for Israeli wines, we spotlight the history of Israeli wines. Adam expertly explains the various epochs of the modern wine industry, what is Argaman, and I also ask about kosher wine, how is it produced, and lastly, we spoke about the effects of attacks and if he knew of any damaged vineyards or wineries. Hi, I'm Mattia Scarpazza, and this is the Looking Into Wine podcast. Wine and winemaking can be complex, but this podcast has a simple mission. We want to give you the skills and tools to harness your passion about wine. Through this series, we will shine a spotlight on some of the different regions, processes, and concepts that shape the fascinating world of wine. I hope you're enjoying the show and your own journey looking into wine. Welcome to the Looking Into Wine. I'm Mattia Scarpazza, your host, and today's guest is a wine industry insider turned wine writer who has contributed to the advance of Israeli wines for 35 years. He's the wine writer for the Jerusalem Post, has been referred as the wine ambassador of Israeli wines and the English voice of Israeli wines. Is the author of The Wine Route of Israel and contributes to and Justice Robinson, the welcome to the show, Adam Montefiore, the Oxford Companion of Wine.
Mattia, hello.
It's good to have you here. It was for me, it was very exciting. It's a new region for me. It's something that I never really looked into a lot, Israel. And when you commented on my LinkedIn saying that it would be an interesting story, something, I was like, yeah, let's do it. Let's do an episode on Israeli wine. And it was such an honor to have you here today.
And Mattia, it's an honor for me. Your podcast is interesting, it gives new information, and I'm quite a fan. So for me, it's quite an honor to be on it.
Thank you, Adam. So let's, because for me, as I said, Israel was a new region. And for me, it was striking me the most. It was like, in 2013, they have about 5,000 hectares of vineyard in such a small country, which is Israel, strike me as equivalent of like almost Côte du Bon in Burgundy, which is quite a lot. Where do we find those vineyards and this? Where are the most of the planting?
Well,
now?
I mean, Israel has been growing wine for only about 5,000 years. So we've been at it a long time. And anyone who has any doubt about the history of Israeli wine should read the Bible. And whether it's the Old Testament or the New Testament, wine appears in every story, thing that the Jesus or the prophets or anyone talks about always relates to wine. So wine was very big in those days. But as I say, we've been making wine for 5,000 years, and in the last 25 years or so, it's got quite good. So we've had a long time to practice. And now Israeli wine is coming to the fore. It's getting third-party recognition, but it's an area of the Eastern Mediterranean, which the Fertile Crescent, which really gave wine culture to the world. So, if you saw fine wine 2,000 years ago coming out of Lebanon or Israel or Greece or Cyprus, it wouldn't be a surprise to wine lovers. Today, it's all retro and it's all new. It's like the ancient world's come to life. But in ancient times, it wouldn't have been surprised to get great wines from these regions. So Israel is in the Levant, which is a British term describing really the basin of the Eastern Mediterranean, the country is covered with vines. And we have vines in the Upper Galilee, the Northern Golan Heights, down to the deepest deserts in the south of the country. But don't be confused that Israel is a big powerhouse in wine. 20 years ago, we were making less than Cyprus, which is a tiny country. There's about 35 countries that make more wine than Israel. If you try and count 35 countries, it's pretty difficult. You get to about 20 and then dry up. there's a vineyard in Monterey, which is larger than the whole wine production of Israel. The boutique winery of Gallo, which used to be called Gallo of Sonoma, produces more wine than the whole of Israel. So we're no way big, but it doesn't detract from the interest value. So this slither of a country,
yeah,
which would fit into Wales or it fit into New Jersey, is a country that throughout history has made wine. And the vineyards traditionally were planted in different places, but the vineyards are everywhere today. When Rothschild, the co-owner of Chateau Lafite, revived winemaking in Israel at the end of the 19th century, he mainly planted in the coastal regions south of Haifa on the northern coast, overlooking the Mediterranean Sea, southeast of what is now Tel Aviv. These were the two areas where the Israel wine industry in modern times was born. But what's happened with the revolution of quality in the last, I mean, it started 30 years ago, but in the last 20 to 25 years, is Israeli wine has moved eastwards towards the Jerusalem mountains and northwards towards the Golan and the Galilee in search of high altitude. Because Israel is on a latitude with North Africa. It's too hot to make quality wine. So what we have to do is climb. So we have high altitude vineyards up to 1,000 meters above sea level. And these provide a coolness, a longer growing season, which allows Israel to enter the market of quality wine.
Okay, and so there's you mentioned the Rothschild, that it was like the precursor of the movement in the, I think, 18th century, late 18th century. He did experiment he was fascinated. What was the story there? What was his influence?
The end of the 19th century. Well, Jews and Christians have always made wine. They made wine at home. Christians made it to use the wines that they were growing. Monasteries made wine. And Jews always needed to make wine for their religious ritual, for the Sabbath, for the festivals, where wine is a necessity to the Jewish people. So a Jewish family would make wine at home. And in fact, the wine that we've bought to drink here is made by a family that were making wine, started making wine in 1848. Yeah. And they started as a winery. This is the Shaw family. Yeah. They started as a winery making wine at home for the family, for the community, and eventually it grew, and eight generations later, they're still making wine. So they were making wine using grapes grown by Arab-owned vineyards near Hebron 170 years ago. In the 1880s, Jews started returning to Israel from Eastern Europe, and they became farmers, and they started planting everything. And what worked in Israel, which is a Mediterranean country, was vines and olive trees, because the soil in certain areas is poor. You know the old thing they used to say about Greece: if you can plant a product or a crop, plant it. But if you can't plant it because the soil is so poor, plant vines and olive trees. So because they go anywhere, you know, they will grow where nothing else will grow. And this is what happened in Israel. So vines and olive trees got planted, and the settlers who arrived in Israel at that time created farming villages, and they lacked funds and they lacked expertise. So they approached the Rothschild family, and Baron Edmund de Rothschild, who was the co-owner of Chateau Lafitte, no less, sent experts, he sent agronomists, he built the two largest wineries in Israel, he planted vineyards everywhere, he started what became a modern Israeli wine industry. And when he came to Israel for the first time in 1887, he fell in love with the wine industry and the country. And then he insisted in bringing Bordeaux varieties.
Yeah.
Because Bordeaux varieties, he said, we want to make a great wine. He said, Israel has no place making wine and competing with Algeria and Bessarabia, which is Moldova, and Georgia, which were the bulk producers at that time. We'd have to make a fine wine. So he insisted on planting Cabernet Sauvignon and Malbec and Cabernet Franc. And all his experts said, you can't plant them, they won't grow. But he wanted to make a fine wine. Of course, his dream didn't work because the yields were so low, the growers got annoyed. They wanted high yields. The grapes all got phylloxera and had to be grubbed up. And there was no demand for a quality Israeli wine. People wanted Kiddush wine, which is sacramental wine for Jews, or altar and communion wine for Christians from the Holy Land. This was the market. So his dream failed, and they ended up planting Carignan and Alicante. But 100 years later, in 1983, when the Golan Heights Winery was formed and Yarden wines started winning awards all over the world, putting Israel on the wine map, then the varieties that were used was Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot and Sauvignon Blanc. So the Baron, Edmund de Rothschild, he was right. His vision was right. But it took 100 years for it to come true.
Yeah, he didn't find that he was in the coastal area and didn't find that the mountains.
That's right.
And now there is this exploring of the mountain sides or the hill sides of the in Israel. And
that's right. Israel, let me remind listeners, is a thin country. And like countries like Italy and Chile, which are long and thin, there is enormous range of microclimates. For instance, in Israel, a harvest will last from the middle of July to the end of October, possibly to the first week in November sometimes. So it's an enormous long harvest, which explains the variety of microclimates that we have in Israel.
You were to sort of identify the different area, because I know there are like five regions. How do you sort of identify them? What's the?
Well, Israel is a is the topography of Israel is vertical, so you have what I call a sandy coastal plain that runs down the country. Then you have rolling hills. Then you have mountains down the spine of the country. And then you have the Judean desert, and which runs into the Negev desert. So half the country is desert. So the main regions are the Galilee, the great Galilee region, which we read in the Bible, where Jesus changed water into the wine. It was in the Galilee. And the Galilee is where they're making great wine today. And the Galilee borders on Lebanon, and the upper Galilee, the higher part of Galilee, is not so far away from the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon, where Chateau Moussard is made. Just think of it. Yeah. If this was a region, it would comfortably fit in California. So it's a fascinating fascinating region of the ancient world. You know, you talk about wineries from the New World and the Old World. Well, here, We're talking about the ancient world. So the Galilee is one of the regions in the north of the country. In the northeast of the country, we have the famous Golan Heights, where the Golan Heights Winery was really the Robert Mondavi Winery of Israel, in that they created a quality wine industry in Israel. And they, the Golan Heights is very famous for being volcanic and high altitude, up to 1,200 meters. And it's volcanic basalt stone soil. And this is where the Yarden label is made. Then you have the coastal plain. In the coastal plain, you have the northern coastal plain, an area people know as Zichron Yaakov. Zichron Yaakov is south of Haifa on the coastal plain. And this is where Carmel Winery's famous old winery, a winery that was founded in 1892, the oldest factory or winery still in existence in Israel, with the deep underground cellars built by Rothschilds. This is in the northern coastal plain in Zichron Yaakov. You have what the central mountain area, which is this mountain area that runs down the spine of Israel. And the most famous region of that is the Judean Hills, where wineries like Castel, Sorah, some of the most famous boutique wineries come from. You have the Judean foothills or Judean plain, which is really in between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, where the hills rise as they go eastwards. And then finally, you have the Negev Desert, which the interesting thing about the Negev Desert, it's very high altitude, and where they grow grapes, it gives you the chills, Mattia. You take a flight to Eilat, you look out the window, it's desert, and suddenly you see a square patch of green, and it's a vineyard someone's planted. So here they are making the desert bloom, and vineyards are growing in the desert, 800 meters above sea level. There are very few diseases because it's so dry. But it's very cold at nighttime and high altitude, and they're making some great white wines from the Negev Desert. So this is basically the Israel. Most of the climate is Mediterranean, which is hot summers, wet winters, snow on the high mountain peaks of the Galilee and the Central Mountains and the Golan in the winter. And 50, 60% of the country is desert or semi-arid desert.
Okay. And you mentioned earlier about the boutique wineries, which is something very important in Israel, because there's a lot of them and there's big influence from them. And they all started with the Golan Heights, and then people trying to plant them. Where do they get the influence from? What's the idea behind those so many boutique garage wineries?
Yeah, let me give you a timeline. So you know, the Shaw family, 1848 winery, Tzion Winery. They were the wineries that started in the old city of Jerusalem in 1848, making wine, which was more a domestic industry. Then came the 1880s and 1890s, when Rothschild founded the largest winery, which was called Carmel Winery. And this became, was with French expertise. He sent French agronomists, the flying winemaker to advise them was the winemaker of Chateau Lafite. And the first winemaker was sent from Bordeaux to be the winemaker. So they really wanted to make quality wine. And for 100 years or so, Carmel was the Israeli wine industry. Then in the 1880s, the Golan Heights Winery with Yarden, Gamla, and Golan brands was formed. They brought in Californian expertise. So Carmel was founded on French expertise. The Golan Heights Winery brought in Californian expertise. And they really brought in new world technology for the first time, which is crucial to making wine in a hot country. That was the Golan Heights Winery in the 80s. In the 90s, they started a boutique winery revolution, which meant the grower who sold his crop to the big wineries decided, I'm going to keep a bit part of it back, and I'm going to make a boutique wine and sell a wine with my name on. So the most famous of the boutique wineries is Marguerite Winery and Domaine du Castel Winery. Marguerite Winery, Yair Marguerite studied at Davis. So it's, again, the Californian link. Domaine du Castel, he was an Egyptian-born Italian who came to Israel and was a Francophile. So he called his wine Domaine du Castel. He wrote on the label, instead of Judean Hills, Eau Judée. And he wrote on the label of his top wine, Grand Vin. And he basically learned out of a book from Émile Penaud how to make wine. Now, and he was the first of the boutique wineries to really become famous and well known. There's a fantastic story that an actress and food writer in Israel just happened to send a bottle in 1995 of his wine to Serena Sutcliffe, master of wine and head of Sotheby's. And Serena Sutcliffe wrote back saying it's the finest Israeli wine she's ever tasted. Congratulations and all the rest of it. On the basis of this, exactly the same thing happened, by the way, in Lebanon, in Greece, and it's happening now in Cyprus and Turkey. You know, initially there was the big monopoly wineries, which in our case was Carmel. And then in the 2000s, the big wineries started their own mini revolution to compete. And so this took the whole industry forward. Another small winery, which is very good, is Flam. And he learned in Italy. So you can see that people learned in different places. The inspiration of the wineries is in different places. And one of the most exciting things about Israel today is we have a mosaic of winemakers.
As a quite nice juxtaposition from an old world producing wine from 5,000 years and now looking for new world expertise, and sounds very buzzing, or something very interesting happening in the region. And I call it
we're a new world wine region from one of the oldest wine growing regions in the world, which sums up the paradox.
Yeah, it does. And we're talking about the great varieties. Obviously, you mentioned Cabernet Sauvignon and Cabernet Franc brought by the Rothschild, and then brought up by the Golan Heights. But also, what other grape are you finding? And is there any sort of native varieties we should look at?
Again, let's look at it from a history point of view. When they started planting varieties in Israel, firstly, they used the local indigenous varieties. So when the Shaw family was making wine in 1848, they used the indigenous local varieties that now people are talking about. So what goes around comes around. So in those cases, in that case, they were from Hebron, from Arab-owned vineyards, and they took these grapes. Some of the grapes we're going to mention in a minute, they were used then. And then Carmel started, and Carmel used, the French agronomists decided what's suitable for Israel is south of France, Mediterranean varieties, because they considered the climate of Israel, or Palestine it was then called, to be similar to the south of France. So we got Grenache and Carignan and Alicante, and grapes like this were planted. Then Rothschild came and said, plant the quality Bordeaux varieties. It didn't work. So the main varieties for the first 100 years of Israel were Alicante and Carignan. And these were used for everything, for grape juice, for cheap red wines, for blends, for varietals, for sacramental wine. And Carignan became the workhorse grape of Israel wine. Since the 2000s, the biggest variety planted is Cabernet Sauvignon. The third biggest variety is Merlot. We have a lot of Syrah or Shiraz. We have Sauvignon Blanc and Chardonnay. So we have all the international varieties that everyone has. In the first instance, the Golan Heights Winery made varietals, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnay. And these were the wines that first won awards in different competitions worldwide. And people said, wow, Israeli wine. What's happening lately is there's a move to Mediterranean varieties, or rather a move back to Mediterranean varieties. And that means new clones of Grenache and Mourvèdre and Syrah have been planted. Not only people are now using less varietals and more blends. So some people are blending Bordeaux varieties with Mediterranean varieties. Some people are blending Mediterranean varieties. So Israel is making wines at its most interesting, like the Southern Rhone. Blended wines, innovative blended wines, red and white. This is the main hub of Israeli wine. So there was a move away from varietals. There's a move to blended wines. There's a move to Mediterranean wines. There's a move to more elegant wines from more bombastic wines. We went through a high alcohol, oaky period like Australia and California, which thankfully we've now come out of. So that's where we're at. But in the last 10 years, the certain wineries have gone back to investigating these local varieties. And most famous of these, the first one of these, is Cremizan, which is a monastery with a winery founded in 1890. In 2008, they started making wines from varieties like Baladi, like Hamdani, Gendali, and Dabuki. And they got investment from Italy for equipment and expertise. And the flying winemaker, or the consultant winemaker is them, is someone you've heard of, Riccardo Cotarella.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Riccardo Cotarella. I probably pronounced it wrong, but he is their consultant winemaker. And in 2008, they started making wines from these varieties. In 2012, an Israeli called Dr. Shibi Drori started trawling throughout the country of Israel to pick up any variety he could find. This could be wild varieties found in riverbeds, found in gardens, found growing up a pagoda or a tree. And he took in over 100 varieties that he found. He identified them. He checked the DNA and studied them. And 20 of these have the potential to make wine. So he has a micro winery. He's propagating them. He's making wine from them, and his winery, which is Gevaot Winery, is also making wine from these wineries. In 2014, the first Israeli winery was Recanati Winery that released one of these ancient varieties, which is called Marwawi. Marwawi is a synonym for Hamdani, and they made a wine which had a Palestinian grower, an Israeli winemaker, and it was made at Recanati Winery, which I think is a beautiful combination. You know, we have our political problems. You make wine, and it's a great way to great cooperation. So now these wineries, Ken, sorry.
Before we forget, I think there is one grape, actually a winery. A wine, and then you actually send me over to try it, and I haven't come across before, which is Argaman. What is something unique Israeli? What is it?
So, you know, with all these varieties that we mentioned, they're all indigenous and they grow in Israel. But there is one winery which is new. It's a new creation. It was founded it's a cross that was created in the 1970s by someone who wanted to produce a Carignan with more color. So he crossed Carignan with Sauzo, the Portuguese variety, and he produced a wine that was a variety called Argaman. Argaman in Hebrew means crimson or deep purple. And he produced the Argaman grape, and it was meant to be used for blending. It was meant to take over from Carignan. It never took over from Carignan. But in 2008, one particular winemaker called Avi Feldstein, who was then from Segal Winery, decided he saw hidden potential in Argaman. He planted it in the Upper Galilee.
Yeah.
He treated it like a fine wine, low yields, oak aging, and this sort of thing, and produced a wine that won a big award. And suddenly people realized that Argaman had quality to produce a fine wine. So today, Argaman is an Israeli variety. The main characteristics of Argaman are very deep color, aromas of cherry-led fruit, a slightly peppery touch, a hint of pepper, ground pepper, and a very good acidity, so it's refreshing. Now, the one I've sent you, I could have sent you one from Jezreel Valley. I could have sent you one from Barkan. The one I've chosen, I've sent you because it's new. It's produced by 1848 Winery, which is owned by Yossi Shore. The winemaker is a French-trained winemaker, a French winemaker, Ilan Asulin, who came to Israel to work for the wine in 2011. The variety Argaman is grown in the Galilee in a single vineyard in a place called Ramat Sirin, which has a very basaltic volcanic soil. And it's a single vineyard Argaman. It's oak aged for a number of months, and it's more deep, more serious than some of the other Argamans. Argaman can be two things. It can be a light, crunchy fruit, fruity, good acidity, refreshing lunchtime wine.
Yeah.
Or it can be a deeper, oak-aged, a finer wine, which is this comes into this category. So I chose this because it's been launched now, so I know it's new to most people. So this is the 1848 Winery, Argaman. It's called seventh generation because this is a winery which has eight generations of winemakers. And so they called it seventh generation. And this is the wine. So let me say, you say cheers or salute. Let me say l'chaim, which is what we say in Hebrew, which means to life,
to
cheers.
To life.
So this is a rare Israeli variety, which is made here, and you won't find it anywhere else. So this is the
Argaman variety. I tried it earlier. It was very nice. I really enjoyed it. It added the spice and the herbs and the richness. But it was something unique, and it was always exciting to try something new. Something different I never tried before.
Yeah.
And before I let you go, because I had for me it was a bit difficult to understand what is the difference between like the kosher wines and non-kosher wines and the wineries, so the kosher, not kosher. So in a few words, how did they differentiate, and can a winery be producing kosher wine and not kosher wine at the same time?
Good questions. Firstly, the word kosher means pure. And if it's kosher, it allows religious Jews who observe the kosher dietary laws to drink it. But it is not a quality, there's not a quality certificate. You can get a great kosher wine, you can get a bad kosher wine. If it's good, it's well made. If it's bad, it's badly made. So kosher, whether it's kosher or not, does not affect the quality. It's something that kosher is a certificate that's added on the back of the label. You might have a vegan certificate, you might have organic, you might have sustainable. Kosher is another certificate that's added on the back label, which means that the wine has gone through something like an ISO system, checking every ingredient that goes into it. And so it's not harmful designation. By the way, most of the top Israeli wines that we've mentioned, Castel, Yarden, flammed, surah, they're all kosher. So it's not something that affects quality.
Okay.
And Israel are experts on kosher, like New Zealand are experts on Sauvignon Blanc or champagne on sparkling wines. The main thing for a wine to be kosher is that the people handling the wine at the winery have to be religious Jews. And the ingredients used in the winemaking have to be kosher, which means you can't use isinglass because isinglass comes from the sturgeon fish and the sturgeon fish is not kosher. So you use bentonite or something else. So there is no difference between a Cabernet Sauvignon grown in the Napa Valley, in Bordeaux, or in the Galilee. It's harvested the same way. It's made by the winemaker with the same winemaking certificates from Davis or Bordeaux or from Italy. And it's aged in the same way in oak barrels. So if people ask whether it's kosher, I say it's kosher if you want it to be. In other words, if it's important to you as a Jewish, religious Jew, it's kosher. But if not, talk about it Israeli wine, Eastern Mediterranean wine. And really, Israeli wines should be on a wine list and on the shelves alongside other wines from our region, which is the Eastern Mediterranean. So you should get Chateau Moussard and Castel and Yarden and the Cypriot wineries and the Greek wineries all together on the shelves and the wine list under the heading Eastern Mediterranean. Israel shouldn't be under a kosher heading, which is it's misleading.
Okay. Well, for me, it was just to clarify how it work. It was difficult to put my head around it. So thank you for explaining everything, which is very concise and good explanation there.
Thank you.
And I mean, I think we covered a lot of the points I wanted to cover, and I wanted to just obviously with all the, and correct me, I don't know all the in and outs and from what we see from being in Europe and everything, with all the problems that has been in recent months with all the bombing and everything, do you know of any vineyards that have been affected? Has anything been, any region, are they part of the region? I'm talking about out of ignorance here.
No, it's okay. Listen, let me say two things. I'm going to talk at two extremes. I was born in England. I was born in London, brought up in England. And you won't remember because you're too young, but once there was a lot of trouble in Northern Ireland. And on the news in England, every day there were trouble in Northern Ireland. I once went to Northern Ireland to visit distilleries and go around the drinks industry there and saw no trouble at all. I was quite disappointed. And Israel's a bit like that. It's full of normal people. We go about our daily business. Children are going to school. There's a bustle. There's an energy in Israel. And just because the world's media is concentrating on something when it blows up, it doesn't mean we're not a normal country. There aren't tanks in the streets. You can go anywhere. Generally, things are okay. And, we're a normal country from that point of view. On the other hand, just to explain, where we've been at. Used to work for wineries, as you know. I used to work for the Golan Heights Wine. I used to work for Carmel.
Yeah.
I've been at Carmel where I've had to take refuge in these deep underground cellars from bombs, from rockets. One of the vineyards in Meron, there was a suicide bombing and a bus blew up. And body parts had to be scraped off the vines. I had a situation with, in fact, one of the most famous Israeli wines was the Kayumi Shiraz that won the international trophy in the Decanter Fine Wine Awards, World Wine Awards, which is probably the best prize that Israeli wines ever received. And in from the 2006 vintage. And in this vintage, just before the harvest, there was a war between Hezbollah and Israel, and Israeli growers couldn't enter the vineyards in the Upper Galilee because of rockets. And the wine from this vineyard won the big prize. So on one side, I want to say things are normal, and we're very good at carrying on as though they're normal. On the other side, it's not to say that we haven't had our moments and things have happened, but Israelis are masters at carrying on as though everything is normal. And, you know, wine is a wonderful... In ancient times, if you planted a vineyard, in biblical times, if you planted a vineyard, you didn't have to fight as a soldier. You were told, stay home and look after your vineyard. That was how much importance was taken to the long-term potential of a vineyard. And today, I believe a vineyard is an expression of a terroir, and it doesn't matter. A grape doesn't know politics, and it doesn't know whether it's Israeli, Palestinian, Lebanese, or wherever. And we're just out to make the best wine we can from the particular vineyard of that terroir, from a grape that's apolitical. And the wine industry is trying to continue something normal and express the best of Israel, which is its agriculture, its dynamism, its vitality, its creation, startup nation, to create quality wine in a place where wine has been made for thousands of years. It's a country or an area which will always be controversial because of its history and the importance to the three faiths. But wine somehow seems to be a very peaceful occupation. And Mattia, let me tell you, if we drank more wine and less coffee in this area, it would be a far happier place.
Okay, well, thank you for the insights. It was very interesting to hear, and your first-hand experience is something unviolable, and nobody else could ever say your story. Adam, I wanted to thank you for this time together, and once again, it was very nice to have you as a guest. A new region for me, very exciting news, very exciting region, and very exciting wines coming from there. And thank you again for being here today.
Thank you very much, and please continue with your podcasts. I like to listen when I'm taking my dog a walk in the evening. I like to plug it in and put my headphones on and listen to your podcast and learning about the rest of the wine world. So please continue your great work.
Thank you. I appreciate it. You listen to the Looking Into Wine podcast, discussion on Israeli wines with guest Adam Montefiore. You can find Looking Into Wines on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and every major listening app. If you enjoy the podcast, you can donate on mattiascarpazza.com. Music produced by Samuele Di Nardo, editing and mastering by Tommaso Ascoli.